Let's begin. Welcome everyone, my name is John Spine. I'm part of the Knights of the Southern Cross, of which God and Beer is an initiative. And I wanted to welcome you all here tonight and then begin with a prayer. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. St. Mary of the Cross MacKillop.
Pray for us.
St. Thomas More.
Pray for us.
In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Alright, so obviously we're in a different venue to our normal God and Beer venue tonight. We've had to move from the Notting Hill Hotel because of the exceptionally large crowd. We were a little bit worried that there might be a riot because we don't have any beer tonight. We thought about changing it to God and soft drink, but it didn't have the same ring. So we're still calling it God and Beer, despite there being no beer, sorry about that. Liquor licenses are hard to get, it turns out. So our speaker tonight hardly needs an introduction. Tony Abbott is one of the most consequential politicians that Australia's ever had. He served as Prime Minister for 3 years, or the better part of 3 years, and had an enormous impact during his time in politics. He was well known for his leadership and dedication to principle. He was known as a conviction politician. And he was often known to speak about faith, which a lot of politicians are reluctant to do, but Tony had the courage to do that. So I don't actually know what Tony's going to speak about tonight, but I'm sure it's going to be interesting. Please join me in welcoming Tony Abbott.
Well, John, thank you, and ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here. And yes, I wasn't too sure what I was going to speak about either. I thought the topic was God and beer, and I thought I was at least half qualified to talk on that topic. Then I was told the topic was God and Caesar, and I thought I'm probably completely unqualified to talk about that topic. As a failed seminarian and as someone who was kicked out of the Prime Ministership by my colleagues and kicked out of my seat by my voters. Nevertheless, I am very pleased to be here and I am delighted to be able to talk about some of the issues facing our society and what good people might do about it. I've got to say, I always approach gatherings like this with a great degree of humility. Not long before I first went down to Canberra as a staffer for the then leader of the opposition, John Hewson, I was working in the garden one Sunday morning and my wife suddenly came out of the house waving the newspaper at me and she said, "At last, something good in the paper." And I read it and it said, "Tony Abbott is a cross between Attila the Hun and Vlad the Impaler." And I said, "Darling, what's so good about that?" And she said, "Well, now at least people know what I've got to put up with." She's a formidable woman, my wife. Some years later, there was a cabinet reshuffle, and there was I was very happy with the result of this reshuffle, so I charged home, and there was my wife standing at the top of the stairs waiting to receive me. And I rushed up to meet her and I said, "Darling, I have just been appointed leader of the house." She said, "Not in this house, you know." But look, I regard myself as very much a disciple of the late, great B.A. Santa Maria. And as any of you who have read his memoirs would know, towards the end of his book, he says, of his work and the work of the National Civic Council, he says, "In all this, we were but minnows swimming in giant and stormy seas." But then he adds, "Even the minnow must do what he can." And that's our challenge, to do what we can in these difficult times to make them better. And yes, they are extremely dispiriting times. I like to think that we might be getting to peak insanity, but certainly there is a huge dollop of insanity about so much in our public life and in the way our society works these days. And there's the climate cult. There was the recent virus hysteria. There's the gender fluidity push. There's the magic pudding economics. And perhaps worst of all, there's this sense of cultural self-loathing, notwithstanding the fact that our society is as free and as fair and as prosperous as any on earth, notwithstanding the fact that our society is as colourblind and as least racist as it's possible to be. I must say, I think to myself, who would have thought that today, in the 21st century, we would want to rely on Mother Nature to provide all our power needs? Who would have thought that any serious person in public life could seriously think that intermittent wind and solar power could somehow power a modern economy that needs power 24/7? Who rationally would think that somehow the law can trump biology when it comes to saying whether someone is male or female? Who would have thought rationally that government can somehow meet every conceivable need by printing money or quantitative easing, as they call it? And who would have thought that the best way to deal with a disease was to hide under the doona for the best part of 2.5 years? Yet this is the lunacy. These are just some of the lunacies that we have to deal with today. And the worst of all, I think, is the fact that the Western democracies, which, as I said, have been responsible for creating the best times in human history, the Pax Americana, under which people have been more free, more rich, more safe, and more justly dealt with than at any time in human history. The Pax Americana is now under horrific challenge from dictatorships on the march, whether it's the militarist dictatorship in Moscow, whether it's the Islamist dictatorship in Tehran, or the communist dictatorship in Beijing. Our countries, Australia and our like-minded countries, are under challenge in a way unknown for almost a century. So our job is to do everything we humanly can to put backbone back into our communities and to put backbone back into our polity. Now, most of us here are Christians, and we're all familiar with the biblical injunction, that wonderful Christ-like wisdom to render unto God the things of God and to render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's. That was what the good Lord told us. But in rendering to God what's properly his, that doesn't exempt us from doing what we can to make this world better than it currently is. I was lucky enough to be taught by the Jesuits. And the Jesuits said, be a man for others. And being a man for others is not confined to the household. It's not confined to the neighbourhood. It's not confined to your workplace. It's certainly not confined to church. Being a man for others should extend to every field of human endeavour, including our public life. You know, these days there are some people who talk about the Benedict option. There are some people who want us to retreat to a kind of fortress of faith, to give up on a fallen world. And I can understand that, because so often you look around, you see families disintegrating, you see societies that no longer know what they believe. I can understand the urge to retreat. I can remember saying to the late great Cardinal Pell some years ago that maybe it's back to the catacombs. But I didn't mean for a moment that we should retreat. What I meant when I said that to my friend the Cardinal was that the world would want to drive us to the catacombs. But instead of retreating, instead of, I suppose, accepting defeat, that just means that we should be stronger in our faith and braver in its expression, even in public life.
Yeah.
Now, I don't say that decisions in this secular democracy of ours should be made on the basis of faith rather than reason. But I do say that this society of ours has always been based on a foundation of faith. On the corner of Hunter and Castle Ray Streets in Sydney, there's a beautiful monument, small compared to the skyscrapers that now surround it, but incredibly significant because that monument commemorates the first sermon preached in this new world. And the preacher, the Reverend Richard Johnson, took as his text, "What can I render unto the Lord for all his blessings to me?" Now just imagine, back in February 1788, the first fleet had arrived, 1,500 souls, most of them prisoners, the rest of them probably scarcely less bewildered guards, transported halfway around the world to a place they'd never known and could scarcely understand, and yet the first sermon preached in this land, "What can I render unto the Lord for all his blessings to me?" Faith and optimism, they were the foundations of this settlement, and they should still, to this very day, be at the heart of our country. I am confident that for all the faults of our current polity, for all the weaknesses of our present political parties, they would be vastly better if there were more people of conviction, more people of deep faith in them. As I said earlier, one of my earliest and best political mentors was the late great B.A. Santa Maria. And B.A. Santa Maria had one fundamental message that he would give to everyone who would listen: join the political party of your choice and make it as good as it possibly can be. So that's my message to you, in fidelity to that great mentor of mine. Please join the political party of your choice and make it as good as it can be. Yes, you want your parishes, you want your churches to be as good as they can be, but no less important is making our polity as good as that can be, and that is best done through the political party which best represents your fundamental values and instincts, or perhaps least fails to represent your best values and instincts. Now, I've got to say that I'm very indebted to John Smythe for inviting me tonight. And I'm just about to sit down and take a few questions, but I am very indebted to John for his invitation. You know, he originally said that I was being invited to spirituality in the pub. Now I discover that what I'm actually being invited to is a meeting of the Knights of the Southern Cross. And yet, what better subterfuge for a secret society than to disguise a Knights of the Southern Cross meeting as spirituality in the pub. Thank you very much.
Tony, I'm going to abuse my privilege as MC to ask the next question. I'm a school teacher myself, and I've got a real passion for classical Christian education. I'm part of a movement trying to help it grow here in Australia. It's huge in America, but quite small and new here in Australia. And I know you recently gave a speech in the USA at the Great Hearts Institute to a classical Christian education conference. I'm really interested to hear your thoughts on classical education and what you would like to see happen with it here in Australia.
Well, thank you, John. I did go to America early in the year to talk to the National Classical Education Conference. And I was invited to this conference because a wonderful young woman who'd worked for me as Prime Minister had gone off as a Rhodes Scholar to get a doctorate, worked briefly as an academic in the United States, and now she's helping to run these Great Hearts Academies, 40 schools with a rigorous classical curriculum scattered around the Sunbelt states of the United States. And there are others doing much the same thing. Probably something like 5% of young people in the United States are currently being educated in these classical schools, and that number is growing all the time. And I think it would be really wonderful if we had more of that here in Australia. Some years ago, in 2008, when I was the Shadow Minister for, amongst other things, Indigenous Affairs, I decided that in my time in Parliament, I visited dozens and dozens of Aboriginal communities, but I hadn't spent more than about 12 hours in any of them. And so I rang up Noel Pearson and said, look, Noel, would I be able, if sort of sponsored by you, to go and spend a few weeks in a remote Aboriginal place, not just as a tourist, but as someone who was trying to be at least useful. So my first stint was to be a teacher's aide in the school at Cowan in Cape York, a place of about 300 people, mostly Indigenous. And honestly, it was such an eye-opener. The teacher in this Year 8 class was straight out of Teachers College, and these unruly kids basically destroyed her every day. They destroyed her every day, and I was there attempting to help, but it was pretty difficult given that she was expected, under these crazy modern theories, to prepare an individual class every day. Imagine it, having to prepare a 6-hour long class every day on your own. Impossible. And the result was just utter and complete confusion. Well, a few years later, Noel had put in place, with some help from, by that stage, the Abbott government, a program called Good to Great Schools, which was all about explicit instruction. Highly scripted, very, very, very heavily programmed. A bit like the old multiplication tables that most of us can remember. Only the same kind of sing-song routine would happen in just about everything. Well, in 2015, that's 7 years after my dreadful experience of classrooms in Cowan, I spent a few hours in classrooms up at the tip of Cape York, completely, utterly transformed. The teachers were following a rigorous and planned script. The kids were advancing incrementally all the time. The satisfaction, palpable satisfaction from the teachers, and the obvious pleasure in the kids. And these were not educationally advantaged kids. These were kids for houses where there probably weren't too many books, if any at all. But the pleasure on the faces of these kids as they could feel themselves mastering something. And probably for some of them, it was the first thing they'd ever been good at and the first time they'd ever been good at anything in their lives except making up. Well, absolutely wonderful. And I so hope that amongst all the modern lunacies, this idea of the teacher as a guide by your side, this idea that education is not about imparting the best that's been thought and said, it's somehow imagining that innate in every kid is the creativity of Leonardo da Vinci and the wisdom of Newton and Aquinas. It's complete nonsense. It needs to be taught, and that's why we need a much more rigorous classical style curriculum.
Thanks so much, Tane. That was awesome. I know I can call on you when we try and get a classical school started here in Melbourne now. You knew, well, the late, great Cardinal Pell and stood up for him when he was unjustly convicted, even visiting him in prison, when it was extremely unpopular to do so. I'm sure you would have you received a lot of criticism for that at the time, even though it's since been vindicated. Could you tell us what Cardinal Pell meant to you and to the Church in Australia?
Okay, well, I've been incredibly lucky in that over the years I've had a lot of people wiser and mostly older than I am who have dedicated some of their time and wisdom to helping me to be a better person. Now, first person, of course, was my dad, sadly no longer with us. But then when I was a kid at school, a fellow, a Jesuit called Emmett Costello, was almost like a second father to me. Then V.A. Santa Maria, who I've mentioned. I'm not sure that he always felt that proud of me, but I regarded myself as John Howard's political son there. And certainly I learned an enormous amount from him. But as time went by, if there was one person who I turned to for counsel and inspiration, it was Cardinal Pell. The great thing about Cardinal Pell was that he was an exemplar of sanctity and wisdom and insight, not just into the affairs of the church, but into the things of this world. And so there was a time in the 2004 election campaign, in the run-up to the 2004 election campaign, when I came into the possession of some very difficult and awkward information. And I thought, I honestly don't know what I should do with this. If I told any of my political colleagues, I would have made it their problem, not mine. And I thought, I need to talk to someone who is very wise and very knowledgeable, but not involved. So naturally enough, after Mass one morning, I went to see the Cardinal in his presbytery at St Mary's Cathedral. He got all the information that I had and then gave me extremely good advice, which I followed and which resolved this particular situation in the best possible way. And that was so typical of the Cardinal. If you had a problem and you took it to him, he would do his best to help you, not just by offering to pray for you, important though that is, not just by giving you the party line, as it were, that we all know already, but by attempting to give you something which is realistic and practical in the actual difficulties of the day. So I regarded him as really as good as any man I've ever known, and to this day I miss him. But as with all great people who have become a very important part of your life, they live on in your heart. And in the case of Cardinal Pell, not only is he, we hope and believe, praying for us in a better place, but he's also left behind three wonderful works of spiritual wisdom and insight in his prison diaries. I think Cardinal Pell is the greatest churchman Australia has ever produced. I think he is arguably, if not the greatest, one of the very greatest Catholics that Australia has ever produced. And I think it is the duty of all who knew him to try to ensure that he remains just as real to the Australian Catholics of future generations as, for instance, someone like Winston Churchill is to successive generations of people who are interested in democratic politics.
This questioner asks, you're a surf lifesaver, firefighter, former PM, a force of nature to do all of those things concurrently. What drives you and what's next?
Well, I guess different things drive you at different times to do different things. I became a politician because I'd earlier been a journalist, and eventually I figured that I didn't just want to observe things, I wanted to do things. I didn't just want to be a watcher, I wanted to be a participant, an executive, if you like. So that was what, I guess, took me out of writing for the Australian and into the Parliament. I became a surf lifesaver because I wanted the kids to understand surf craft. So I took them down to Nippers in Queenscliff when they were young, and it soon became clear that the club expected the parents to do their bronze medallion and then do patrols, and after a few years the kids gave up Nippers, but by that stage I was hooked. I actually gave them an excuse to go to the beach every Sunday morning. So it wasn't all hardship, I can tell you that, John. And as for the fire brigade, well, it was the Friday after the Olympics in 2000. I was door knocking in Killarney Heights. It was a very hot day, unseasonably hot. There was a fire in the valley adjacent to Killarney Heights, and you could watch the fireballs rolling up the hill towards the Wakehurst Parkway. And as soon as I got back to the office, I rang the local fire headquarters and I said, look, I'm your local member, I'd like to be helpful. And they said, well, okay, you might be able to come and make a few sandwiches, but if you're not trained, that's all you can really do. And I thought, well, much as I think making sandwiches is a good thing, I'd rather do a bit more than that. So the next Sunday, a couple of days later, at Nippers, I was with a mate of mine whose kids were at Our Lady of Good Counsel, and also his kids and mine were at Nippers together. And I said to him, that fire must have come pretty close to you. And he said, look, I was sitting on my veranda on the Friday night drinking beer, and there were all these poor people at the end of the street trying to put the fire out. He said, I feel so guilty, I'm going to join the local brigade. I said, well, let's both of us do it. So we both went up, joined the local brigade. He gave it 10 years, and almost 25 years later, I'm still there. I did actually step down as a deputy captain a few weeks back because just at the moment I'm too busy to get to all the meetings that you're expected to go to, and I'm a bit, I'm not always able to do the, continuing courses that you're supposed to do to stay qualified. But as I said to them, as long as I'm physically capable, I certainly intend to stay an active member of the brigade. And there are a couple of guys in the brigade who are fitter than me in their late 70s, so I reckon I've still got another 10 years service.
This question asks, to what do you attribute the insanity? I think it's referring to the insanity that you kind of catalogued earlier on, you know, all the crazy things we see happening, especially in Anglosphere countries, so America and England and Australia. To what do you attribute that kind of craziness?
Well, that's a really good question. I suppose we, before we get too depressed about these times, we probably should recall that there have been better and worse times in our history. By comparison which with what had gone before, the period of the Roman Empire, at least in its best days, was a big improvement. Sure, it was horrific compared to today. I mean, there was slavery. There was the total subordination of women. There was grotesque attitudes of one group for another and so on. But nevertheless, in terms of, I guess, philosophical wisdom, in terms of engineering skill, in terms of the ordinary accompaniments of life, the Romans really took things to a higher level. And then, of course, we had the Dark Ages, where so much of that was lost and life became once more nasty, poor, British, solitary and short. And then we had the beginning of the Middle Ages, the Renaissance, the Reformation, the Enlightenment, and people in 1900 thought that their world, certainly European people in 1900, thought that their world was one of unparalleled prosperity and wisdom and decency, la belle époque, it was called. And then, of course, the catastrophe of the Great War, in which the best people of a generation were consumed. So, look, frustrating and dispiriting though these times are, there have been frustrating and dispiriting times in the past, and our challenge is never to despair. I mean, the point I keep making is that effort does not guarantee success, but lack of effort does guarantee failure, and a majority which stays silent does not long remain a majority, which is why we've got to be prepared to speak up in a good cause, even if it's difficult. We have to. But you ask, John, what do I think the cause is? Well, I think, to use a jargon term, it's kind of multifactorial. But if there's one thing that I would point to as the biggest single difference between these times and all the times that have come before, is that until a couple of generations ago, the vast majority of people in countries like ours were believers. Yeah. Now, they might not have all been of the one true faith, as it were. They might not have been particularly convinced. They might not have been very virtuous in the way they lived their lives. But nevertheless, they were all, in a sense, or nearly all, in a sense, believers. They knew the gospel stories. They knew the rudiments of Christian teaching. They believed, however sceptically, that there was something after this life, that death was not an extinction, it was a transition. Far fewer of us believe that today. And look, if faith is a gift, some of us have it, some of us don't. Even those of us who haven't, I think the faith waxes and wanes. Mother Teresa is said to have told people that for her the dark night of the soul could last for years at a time. So even the best of us can go through bad times. But this is the first period where a large percentage of the population haven't just lost their faith, but young people lack even Christian knowledge. Even Christian knowledge. I mean, how many people going through state schools today, anywhere in Australia, are getting any familiarity with the gospel stories, the parables? Quite rightly, we are expected to honour the dreaming stories. We are expected to take seriously Indigenous traditions, and yet the traditions which have shaped our world, completely shaped our world, the traditions without which our modern world is unimaginable, well, they're treated with casual contempt and disdain. So I reckon that if there's one thing that really needs to change, at the very least, we need to try to familiarise people with the greater stories on which our culture is based, starting with the New Testament.
Your answer there reminded me of a great quote by G.K. Chesterton. He said, "Modern man hasn't just lost his way, he's lost his address." During your career, you experienced a lot of hostility from the media. Frequently, they went into a rage anytime you mentioned your faith. Why do you think the media is so hostile to Christianity and the Catholic Church in particular? And do you think being openly Catholic affected your political career much?
Well, John, the first point I should make in response to that is that I do not want to hold myself out as some kind of exemplar of virtue. I've always taken my religion seriously. I have usually been a reasonably observant Catholic, but I don't claim to have been anything like a perfect Catholic, and thank God for confession, that's all I can say. And when anyone has ever been tempted to put me on a pedestal, I say, please don't, because pedestals are things that you fall off. No sooner have you been placed on a pedestal than you fall off, normally through your own pride and imperfection. So I just want to make that absolutely crystal clear. Do I think I've suffered for my faith? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I think I have been wonderfully blessed. Absolutely wonderfully blessed. And I'd rather be criticised for something which is good than criticised for something that is bad. So look, I don't regard myself as in any way disadvantaged by the fact that I've been publicly a Catholic. I don't regard myself as disadvantaged at all. And certainly compared to someone like Cardinal Pell, who endured what can only be described as a sort of a living martyrdom, a modern-day crucifixion, I've got off incredibly lightly, and I hope no one would regard any slight sling or arrow that they might get on account of being a serious Christian or a serious Catholic as putting them off for a moment, because honestly, it's the best gift anyone can have, and we should cherish it.
Could you tell us a bit about what feeds your spiritual life? Are there any prayers that you like to say, maybe books that have inspired you, saints that you turn to for inspiration?
Well, again, I'm trying to remember what B.A. Santa Maria said, but I think he basically said that he might have the mind of a European intellectual, but he had the heart and soul of an Italian peasant. And I don't claim to have any sophistication in this area. When I was about 15 in year 10 at school, Emmett Costello said to the class, "Look, kids, it's Lent. I'm not going to tell you to do something like give up chocolates or lollies for Lent. I'm going to ask you to do something positive. There's daily mass every day in the school chapel. Why not for Lent coming along to that, as opposed to the weekly mass that was compulsory?" And I thought, well, that's a good idea. So I went to daily mass for the duration of Lent. I got so much out of it that I thought I should just keep doing this. So for the rest of my time at school, other than very occasionally, I would go to Mass every weekday as well as on Sunday. And naturally enough, in one's sex, drugs and rock and roll period at university, these disciplines slipped somewhat, but not entirely. I tried to go to Mass a lot in those days. Gets a bit harder when you've got young kids, but when I became a Member of Parliament, when Parliament was sitting, I would go to St Christopher's for the 6:45 Mass most days, certainly Tuesdays, Wednesdays and Thursdays. I don't sound as good as that today because I don't have the same routines, but I still think that in terms of one's spiritual life, the best foundation is mens sana in corpore sano, a healthy mind and a healthy body. So exercise every day, try to get to church as often as you reasonably can, and whatever you do, don't forget to say your prayers at night. I'm still very good at that, and I usually find that after about the seventh or eighth Hail Mary, I'll drift off to sleep. And that's pretty good too, as you get older and start to become a bit insomniac.
If you were still in Parliament today, what would you be trying to do to protect the faith? I think there's a sort of big legislation bandied about to protect religious freedom over the last few years. I guess where do you think that needs to go?
Well, John, the problem today is not bad laws. The problem is a bad culture and too many people in positions of authority and influence who don't have good attitudes to things like the Christian religion. So I'm not really in favour of trying to change the law, because the law will be interpreted by judges and by officials, and if you've got substandard people, you'll get substandard results regardless of the law. And I suspect that any change that is supposed to protect religious freedom will end up protecting all sorts of I don't think they'll end up protecting what we would regard as good mainstream religion. I think they'll end up being used to protect eccentric things rather than the things that we really value. So look, what I think is needed is just more people who, for whom good values mean something, more people of human decency and strong character and reasonable convictions. That's what we need. I don't think changing the law is our answer. I don't think new sets of rules are an answer. I don't even think that hitting people over the head with one's faith is the answer. I think it's just living a good life and wherever you have to, standing up for the things that matter. That's the important thing going forward.
You gave a magnificent speech a couple of years ago alongside Professor Jay Bhattacharya from Stanford University, the IPA, and you talked about the problems with the way our government handled COVID. Interested to hear your thoughts on maybe to restate those issues that you saw and how you think the church could have responded better.
Yeah, well, thank you, John. I'm pleased someone recalled that talk I gave at that particular event. Look, I was not as unfortunate as you Victorians, because I lived in New South Wales, and while the virus hysteria was bad in Sydney, it was just diabolical here in Melbourne. I mean, you guys were locked up. Was it six times? One of the lockdowns went for almost 6 months. I can remember, I think I was with Kevin down the back. We were at a restaurant having lunch one day, and all of a sudden we were told by Katerina, the restaurateur, that the joint was being locked down from midnight, and she was going to toss out all the food that she'd bought for the weekend's trade and all that kind of stuff. And I thought, well, I better get myself to the airport and get on a plane as quickly as possible to get out of, you know, Danistan. I can understand the pandemic was a time most of us would prefer to forget, because if you're a young person, you had 2 years of your life stolen from you when schools were closed, universities were closed. If you were a worker, you often had your job taken away from you. If you ran a business, often it was shut down. I mean, the idea that we should stop living for fear of dying, it's so wrong. It's so wrong. We should live to the full, knowing that all of us will die eventually. And the important thing is not to artificially prolong life. The important thing is to fill each day with as much worthwhile activity and good things as we can. And the most dispiriting thing about that whole time was this idea that we somehow did well by doing nothing. We somehow served our country by hiding under the doona. I just think that's so wrong. It's been really bad for our work ethic. And I think it's been really bad for our sense of having a go. I mean, if there's one thing that Australians should revel in, it's having a go. And frankly, people can only get a fair go if at least some of them are prepared to have a go. And yet we were told not to do any of that for the best part of 2.5 years. And I just think that was so wrong and so corrosive. And I just wish and hope that at some point we might have a serious look at exactly what we did to learn the right lessons from it, not in a sense of blame and punishment, but in a sense of resolve never to make the same mistakes again, never ever to make the same mistakes again. When I was the health minister of the Howard government, I spent a lot of time thinking about pandemics, because back then, you might remember, there were periodic cases of bird flu, particularly in East Asia and Southeast Asia, and bird flu had a 30% plus case fatality rate, but it never became a pandemic variant, that's to say a virus that readily transmitted from human to human. You basically had to live with poultry to get it, be a kind of a small farmer to get it. Nevertheless, I was very much aware of the fact that a pandemic could break out at any time, so we did a lot of work figuring out what we needed to do by way of stockpiling medicines, ventilator beds, knockdown kind of fever hospitals and so on that could be built at short notice, what we should do about quarantine and so on. And the essence of the pandemic plan that was put in place was, yes, there would be a period of strict quarantine on the borders to slow the arrival of a pandemic disease in this country, but that wasn't to keep the country locked down or people locked out or locked in for very long. It was to give us the time needed to prepare the health system and to take measures to protect the vulnerable. And I mean, invariably in this situation, the vulnerable are the very old and the very sick. Instead of following the pandemic plans that have been carefully prepared and refined over the best part of 2 decades, in panic, just about every country adopted the Wuhan plan, which was to lock everyone up in the thought that the thing would go away. Well, you can't uninvent these things once they're here. You've just got to live with them as best and as bravely as you can. The only country, in fact, which stuck to the plan was Sweden and some American states. But Sweden was the only country that stuck to the plan. Health-wise, they were middle of the pack. But life-wise, they were absolutely top of the class. And it's a pity we didn't all have the same fortitude.
All right, we're out of time now, so if everyone could join me in thanking Tony for some donation buckets that are going to come around. Now, Golden Beer is a free event, and there's no compulsion to give, but we'd be very grateful if anyone is able to contribute to the costs of organising this event. It isn't cheap, and we'd be very grateful if, when the buckets come around, you can make a donation. I've got Paul Mitchell, who's the State President of the Knights of the Southern Cross, here to present some gifts to Tony. But Tony, I just want to say thank you for your service to our country. You've done a lot to make our country a better place, and I'm sure everyone else here is very grateful for that. Thank you.
We are all very grateful, and we applaud you for coming and spending your time with us. We've gained a lot, and for that we are grateful, and I do have a small token of our appreciation. Yeah. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.